This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
On the program today, tax policy, just a little bit, I promise. Also, some urban sprawl. And oh, look, a big bank gets fined over mortgage-backed securities. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday, it is the 12th day of April. Glad, as always, to have you along, everybody. I spent yesterday in Washington, went for a sit-down with Jack Lew, the Secretary of the Treasury. It was an interview in which we discussed, among a couple of other things, tax policy and how the Treasury Department thinks it ought to be. Today, we've got a reminder that the United States isn't the only place concerned with its accounts receivable. There is a move afoot in the European Union to force big multinational companies, about 6,000 companies all told, to disclose their profits and tax bills for their operations in each of the member states of the European Union, as well as some assorted but yet to be named tax havens. Getting tough on tax avoidance is all the rage in the wake of the Panama Papers, the big disclosure of a weekend or so ago. But it is old hat in the European Union. Marketplace's Annie Baxter gets us going.
Over the past few years, European authorities have paid increasing attention to multinational firms' tax avoidance schemes. Some would domicile in a low-tax place like Luxembourg and get out of paying taxes in other EU countries where they operate. Jacob Kierkegaard is with the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
The Luxembourg authorities and authorities in other EU countries have been giving multinational corporations basically sweetheart deals that allowed them to pay very, very little tax on their operations in the European Union as a whole.
Kierkegaard says the European Commission's proposal aims to block those deals. Some business groups object that the proposal would force multinationals to disclose competitive secrets about their operations. But the global anti-corruption organization Transparency International says the proposal actually doesn't go far enough with respect to tax havens outside of Europe. The group's EU office director, Carl Dolan, says firms would not have to be as specific about the tax havens as they would about their operations in European countries. That means those tax haven countries?
They will not be able to see that country-specific information and will not be able to hold the corporations that are active in their countries to account.
The European Commission proposal requires approval by the European Parliament and a majority of EU governments. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Take a second, by the way, and check out that Jack Lew interview. It was, if I say so myself, pretty interesting. Marketplace.org is where you can find it. All right, moving on. The economy is changing. We all know that. And change, as we also all know, is hard. That gets us to contract talks at Verizon and the 40,000 or so employees there who could go on strike starting tomorrow morning following 10 months of contract negotiations. Marketplace's Nova Sappho reports that at the center of the whole thing is Verizon's change from a traditional phone company to something completely different.
The best way to explain where Verizon is headed is to look at what happened after Hurricane Sandy. Lots of Verizon's old copper phone lines got ripped out. The company didn't even bother to replace those lines in some areas, offering wireless as an alternative.
If Verizon could wave a magic wand and get rid of all of their wireline service overnight, they would do it.
Telecom analyst Jeff Kagan says that's because the number of people who pay for wired phone lines is declining. Verizon says that business now makes up less than a third of its revenues. But the company says wireline workers are expensive. They're unionized, part of a legacy business, and it's those unions that Verizon has struggled with.
The industry is changing, and Verizon can't continue to pay what they've been paying if the business continues to shrink.
Verizon's unions say the business doesn't have to shrink. Unionized workers are responsible for the company's modern fiber optics network, and the unions argue that the company should expand that network. Ian Olgerson of SNL Kagan says Verizon's not likely to do that.
They appear to have lost the appetite for further expansion of fiber to the home.
Instead, the company has been investing in mobile content. It bought AOL, started a video streaming service, and now it's rumored to be preparing a bid for Yahoo. Wireline is in the rearview mirror. Olgerson says even the fiber optics network might not be the solution unionized workers are hoping for.
A fiber network essentially has fewer things to break.
Which means, he says, fewer people needed to maintain it. In Chicago, I'm Nova Safo for Marketplace.
There were some good corporate profits today, rallies in a couple of key sectors. Maybe traders were just in a good mood, too. Who knows? Either way, up was the watchword. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's a headline in the New York Post today that reads like this. Red light camera vigilante strikes again. A guy on Long Island who's made it his mission in life to damage or destroy as many red light cameras as he can. Nobody's advocating vandalism here, but clearly those cameras strike a chord. They're in more than 430 cities and towns across the country, and they can be game changers for police departments looking to reduce accidents and save on actual cop time. But it's not all sunshine and light. There's a backlash in a lot of states against them. 10 have outright bans, and the Missouri Supreme Court shut down St. Louis's camera program last year as unconstitutional. The mayor's office there is trying to get them turned back on, but Joseph Leahy from St. Louis Public Radio reports that opponents see those cameras as less about safer streets and more about just making money.
Two passenger doors on Owen Godwin's 92 Toyota Camry are smashed in, so you have to slide over from the driver's side to take a ride.
Okay, so I'll just climb in on this side.
He says his wife was driving when the Camry got T-boned in South St. Louis by a red light runner.
They denied that they had run the red light, and we had no witnesses, and ended up getting a pretty poor payout from the insurance.
The accident is exactly what red light cameras are meant to prevent. At least video from a camera could have helped Godwin's insurance claim, but St. Louis's program was shut down last August. Even so, the cameras are still mounted at about 35 intersections because city officials are hoping to turn them back on. Police Chief Sam Dotson says the cameras are needed to improve public safety.
We saw that the number of accidents was reduced. We saw that people did not continually run the same electric signals. So I think it had tremendous value.
Charles Torito is with American Traffic Solutions, the U.S.'s largest camera provider, including St. Louis. He says research from across the country backs up Dotson's claims.
And in almost every study that we've seen, the number of violations, the number of collisions, and the number of injuries decrease in communities where red light safety cameras are used.
Chief Dotson says they also free up more officers from having to pull over and ticket red light runners. But there are some who say the cameras are not about saving money, they're about making money. Dan Hyatt is running for a state House seat and supports efforts in Missouri's capital to ban them statewide.
Luckily, Jefferson City has identified the corruption here in St. Louis and is doing everything they can to stop revenue enforcement, taxation by citation.
Hyatt says it's easy for city officials to support the cameras because they're so lucrative. In the 18 months before they were shuttered, St. Louis's program generated $5.6 million in ticket fines. St. Louis had to refund that money after the state Supreme Court shut down the cameras, ruling that it was unconstitutional to fine vehicle owners, even when they weren't driving. Attorney Beavis Schock helped argue the case.
I think what happened was when the cities passed the red light camera program, they didn't understand how big it was going to get and how much money was going to be involved.
Schock says the backlash is nationwide. The cameras generate hundreds of millions of dollars for local municipalities, and that, he says, doesn't sit well with many Americans.
See, the American people kind of understand injustice in their gut, and they know wrong, and they know a ripoff.
Schock and Dan Hyatt are among many who believe the cameras don't necessarily improve safety either. Hyatt points to studies that show rear-end collisions actually increase because of drivers slamming on their brakes.
So what they're doing is they're doing emergency stops, risking accidents, risking rear-end collisions, to avoid getting a red light camera ticket.
He also says that many studies can be skewed because rear-end collisions are significantly underreported and often don't show up in the data. It's for this reason that Owen Godwin, despite his smashed-up Camry, says he's actually relieved the cameras are off. He prefers to use his own judgment at intersections.
You can either speed up or slow down. It's not the fear of the camera going off that's going to drive my decision.
That may end, however. City officials plan to propose a new ordinance to get the cameras issuing tickets again. In St. Louis, I'm Joseph Leahy for Marketplace.
First there was Bank of America, then Citigroup, then J.P. Morgan Chase. Now comes Goldman Sachs. The refrain is a familiar one. Big American bank agrees to an X-billion-dollar settlement related to the sale of mortgage-backed securities in the lead-up to the Great Recession. Goldman's turn in the barrel came yesterday, $5 billion and change, but it is ground well-trod by all the biggies on Wall Street. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson looks at what we've learned about how this whole settlement process works anyway.
For the public, these settlements typically start with an announcement from the Department of Justice and a big headline number. Part of that will be a fine, a penalty. And then there's typically this other pool of money for consumer relief. And that's where things get a little squishy.
You cannot take the announced figure as a particularly reliable measure of the actual relief that will be delivered on the ground.
Catherine Porter is a law professor at the University of California, Irvine. She says settlements may lay out different ways the bank can offer this consumer relief, like loan modifications.
So it might be if you forgive $1 of a second mortgage, you get $1 of credit. That's what people expect.
But the settlement might say banks can log more credit for certain types of relief or for getting the money out the door fast.
The idea is while preserving flexibility to incentivize the kind of help that we think would be most useful on the ground.
She says the Goldman settlement uses these incentives to encourage building affordable housing, which she thinks is a new idea. But Dennis Kelleher, president of the nonprofit Better Markets, thinks this credit system is all about inflating that headline settlement number.
It's a process designed to come up with a big-looking number so the Department of Justice can pretend to be tough on Wall Street, and Wall Street can pretend that it had to pay a big amount.
He says this credit system, combined with tax deductions, means the banks will actually pay substantially less. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Coming up.
It's not only changing the physical form of the city, it's changing the way that we think about those places.
The master's thesis that just might change the way Atlanta builds. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 164 points today, about 0.9%, closed at 17,721. The NASDAQ added 38 points, 0.8%, 4872. The S&P 500 climbed 19 points, nearly 1% there, 2,061. Under Armour gained 0.6% despite a report showing the company is losing market share even as sales keep growing. One weakness, getting women to buy Under Armour. The Craft Brew Alliance sounds like trade organization, but it's a craft brew conglomerate. Kona, Widmer's, Red Hook. Craft Brew, ticker symbol BREW, down 1.3%. Also, Kona, Widmer's, and Red Hook, not craft brews. Don't even get me started. Please. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.77%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Our sustainability correspondent, Scott Tong, is just back from a couple of weeks in Venezuela, where he was looking at what happens in a petroleum-based economy when the petroleum kind of goes away. Oil hasn't gone away, of course, but it is way, way cheaper than it used to be. And in an economy like Venezuela's, where oil is pretty much the whole smash, that's a problem. There are food shortages and lines, an increasingly worthless currency, and inflation estimated at 400%. The collapse raises fundamental questions about Venezuela's leftist, anti-capitalist economic model. It's a model known as Chavismo, after the late President Hugo Chavez. So here is Scott with the latest in a series we're calling Resource Curse.
As the economy crumbles, the socialist government in Venezuela on this day is giving out vaccines to dogs. This West Caracas slum is called La Charanga. And these are the strongholds for the ruling party, trying to survive the worst shortages in inflation ever. This mother is here with two kids and three dogs.
It's been hard to have a pet. Dog food is really expensive and scarce. The cheapest I can buy 1 kilogram is 1,000 bolivars. Last year it was 280.
Much of the country's oil money gets spent here in the slums, on services for the poor, education, medicine, appliances, the world's cheapest gas. It goes back to the one president most Americans have heard of, socialist Hugo Chavez. Here he is in 2012. Chavez, the crooner, the variety show host, the global instigator, was a man of 1,000 quotes about the North American empire, about capitalism destroying life on Mars, about gringos going to hell. His supporters, they often hold a particular economic view. Here's La Charanga representative Rafael Fernandez Soto.
We have an economic war taking place in Venezuela. We're being boycotted by other countries.
That's the framing. Economic warfare. Looking for somebody else to blame, says pollster and frequent government critic Luis Vicente León.
They talk against the private sector, against the imperialism, against the Martians, whatever. Never the government.
¡Viva Venezuela!
Hugo Chavez came to power during a previous oil bust in the late 90s. Then, like now, global supply outraced demand. It hit the petrostates like Venezuela hard, especially the poor. Chavez came, and he delivered, says David Smilby in Caracas. He teaches sociology at Tulane.
So you can imagine if somebody who comes from the poor sectors of society, is dark-skinned, identifies with them, puts forward this charismatic narrative, he's a great communicator about why you're suffering and how things are going to get better, and then he actually does it, I think it's very understandable.
Early in his first term, Chavez went to fellow members of OPEC. He asked them to reduce supply. Prices rose, and so did revenue. His government spent it, cutting poverty and boosting college enrollment. Millions got pensions and health care for the first time. The model was called Chavismo, and it joined a broader leftist trend across South America. But make no mistake, the Chavez boom went hand in hand with an oil boom. Today in Bolivar Plaza in Caracas, the faithful still rally for Chavez even 3 years after his death. His picture and image are everywhere. On city walls, murals, bumper stickers. Even Chavez's signature graces the sides of office buildings.
¡Viva Chavez! ¡Viva Nicolás Maduro!
Susana Quintero visits the plaza regularly to sit by the fountain, she says, and to think.
Cuando no estaba el comandante Chávez,
Before Commander Chavez, we saw a lot of poverty. After Chavez, a lot of money came into our pockets we never saw before.
But for all the fervor, the Chavez economic machine ran into problems years ago. The state cut spending on drilling, and it fired top engineers and geologists. So oil production fell, and so did sales. Separately, currency and price controls choked off other domestic sectors. It became all oil all the time, says energy analyst Rafael Quiroz.
Que la riqueza del petróleo era eterna y era permanente.
We always believed oil revenue would be eternal, permanent. We became addicts to oil money, and we never imagined high prices would take a vacation.
Hugo Chavez died in 2013, a year before oil prices collapsed from $120 a barrel down to $25.
El país se acostumbró a no hacer nada para que ingresara dólares por ninguna otra vía.
His successor, President Nicolás Maduro, has just boosted gas prices, but the economic structure remains broken.
Venezuela is in an absolutely, completely exposed position.
Again, David Smildy of Tulane.
It basically did everything you don't want to do with an oil economy. It spent all its money. It maintained an overvalued exchange rate. That meant it became ever more dependent on this one export called oil.
Now, despite all the rallies, Chavez's party is reeling. It lost a majority in parliament, and Smildy thinks it's the beginning of the end of Chavismo as a leading political force. Yes, Venezuela could adopt orthodox solutions from the Western, quote, imperialists. Cutting spending, diluting the currency, and printing less money might help. But then, it wouldn't be Chavismo. In Caracas, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
One imagines they're tracking the price of crude pretty closely in the halls of power down in Caracas, in which case today will have been a good day for them. Oil was up 4+% in New York, $41.99 a barrel. There is talk, again, of a production freeze coming out of Russia and Saudi Arabia, but hey, we've been here before on that one. History fans among you will know that the city of Atlanta was originally called Terminus, so named for the many rail lines that came together there. Fast forward 160 years or so, and parts of those old railroad beds have become something called the Atlanta Beltline, a proposed 22-mile loop of trails, light rail, redevelopment, and green space that stand in Ryan Gravel's new book as a model for how to design or redesign our cities. The Atlanta Beltline was Ryan Gravel's brainchild, the story he tells in his new book, Where We Want to Live. Ryan, it's good to have you on.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
There you were walking around Paris one day, and basically you had an idea, right?
I had a lot of ideas in Paris.
As one does.
Well, I didn't have the later idea that I think you're talking about until a few years later. But I got interested in infrastructure and the role that infrastructure plays in the development of cities. I mean, I grew up in the suburbs of Atlanta, and to live in a place where you could walk everywhere and ride transit and have very social commute and social experience just walking through the city was exciting to me, and it changed the way that I saw cities.
Which totally makes sense, except for this. And I went to school in Atlanta, so you and I are plus or minus the same age. When I was in school there, and I bet when you were growing up, Atlanta was a very different place. It was smaller. It was more concentrated. There was a downtown core and then some neighborhoods. Now, Atlanta has sprawled to beat the band, right?
Right. Yeah, that's what we are. We're sprawl. It's changed the way that we see the world. I mean, I grew up in the suburbs of Atlanta. My worldview was framed by the perimeter highway. And that's fine, except that now, after generations of building that kind of environment, we're realizing it doesn't work anymore.
You come back from Paris, and you're writing a thesis on urban design, and you come up with this idea for the Atlanta Beltline. Walk us through that one.
Sure. Well, I was interested in infrastructure, sort of a tool of revitalization in the city, and I needed a thesis project that would meet the requirements of both my urban planning degree and architecture. Atlanta is a railroad town. That's mm-hmm. why it exists. Mm-hmm. And my idea was just to, you know, convert it into a transit line that would link to our existing rail line. It would connect 45 different neighborhoods into that system. Hmm. It would support revitalization of those communities. But I never imagined we would do it.
Let me offer a word in defense, just to get back to the sprawl thing we were talking about.
Sure.
Let me offer a defense of sprawl, that it exists because it has worked.
It did, absolutely. In fact, the problem is that we've relied exclusively on that infrastructure for our way of life, and there are limits to it. Chronic health challenges, mounting economic realities for the maintenance of that infrastructure, the inefficiencies and inequities that are inherently built into it, or environmental degradation. There are a lot of unintended consequences of it that are now shifting what our expectations and desires are for the places that we live.
There's also this issue of infrastructure as civic identity. I mean, New York skyline and the LA freeways and you know, congestion in Atlanta, you know, that kind of thing.
These projects are connected back into what is inherently of that place. It's not only changing the physical form of the city, it's changing the way that we think about those places. And all these projects have similar kind of challenges because they're in degraded urban conditions. Yeah. They're often also associated with underserved communities. And so the issues of gentrification and equity and who benefits from these changes are all very real. And in that sense, pretty exciting projects to work on, because maybe they're the new infrastructure for a more equitable and diverse future for the country.
So you did this. Yep. You did the Beltline as a thesis project. I have to ask before I let you go, what you got? What you got on your thesis?
Oh, it was pass or fail. You either graduate or you don't, and I did, fortunately.
Ryan Gravel is an urban designer in Atlanta. His book is called Where We Want to Live. Ryan, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
This final note on the way out today, in which I think it's become clear that humanity has too much time on its hands. From the Wall Street Journal today, this item: there is now a website where, for the low, low price of $5 a month, you can watch 24/7 some guy and his buddies fight zombies. It's called Zombie Go Boom, if you want to look it up. The founder says he's got hundreds of paying subscribers. I'd make a joke here about the apocalypse being upon us, the zombie apocalypse perhaps, but I just can't anymore with this. All right, that's the whole thing. The Dow Industrials up 164 points today, 0.9%. The NASDAQ up 38 points, 0.8%. The S&P 500, 19 points higher, nearly 1%. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital team includes Nishat Kerwa, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.